I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy. For the next 2 hours, we're going to be occupying the WGBH airwaves on a special edition of Boston Public Radio.
We are, Jim, but don't get too comfortable in that chair, you know what I mean? Barney Frank is angling for one more stint on Capitol Hill. Is Governor Deval Patrick ready to give him the go-ahead?
And Billy Sine did 2.5 years in prison after he hit State Trooper Ellen Engelhardt. Since she has now died, he is facing 15 more years in prison.
Panera is opening this pay-what-you-want restaurant model in Government Center. You think anybody's going to pay more than they should?
You mean other than me, Marjorie?
Yeah.
And it is the 15th anniversary of the movie Good Will Hunting with local Cambridge kids, Damon and Affleck. How do you like them apples? We're going to be taking your calls here, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. That's today on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Minutes from now, bells will toll in Tucson, Arizona, to mark the second anniversary of a mass shooting at a supermarket. 6 people died, 13 were wounded, including then-Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was meeting with constituents at the time. While still on the road to full recovery, Giffords is now launching a gun control initiative in the wake of another mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut last month. NPR's Windsor Johnston has the story.
Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, say their plan will help raise money to support greater gun control efforts. They say the goal is to generate funds necessary to balance the influence of the gun lobby. The couple last week visited Newtown, Connecticut, where a gunman opened fire in an elementary school, killing 20 students and 6 adults. Giffords and Kelly have also spoken with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a gun control advocate. They're hoping their efforts will spark a national conversation about gun violence and raise money for political activities so lawmakers will no longer have to fear the gun lobby. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The White House is stepping up discussions over gun violence in response to last month's shooting rampage in Connecticut. Vice President Joe Biden is due to meet with gun control groups tomorrow, then gun rights advocates on Thursday. It's part of President Obama's edict across the administration to present proposals by the end of this month on ways to curb gun violence. In Colorado, survivors of the movie theater shooting in July are spending a second day hearing detailed testimony about the attack and the accused shooter, James Holmes. The defendant has reportedly shown little emotion at his preliminary hearing that is expected to lead to a trial. The Aurora shooting killed 12 and wounded dozens more. 7 major regional banks are asking the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to give them a year to comply with new mortgage lending rules the agency is set to release. The rules are aimed at avoiding a repeat of the subprime mortgage crisis. NPR's Craig Windham reports the banks are warning that without extra time, lenders may have to consider scaling back or discontinuing mortgage-related activity.
The banks pushing the Consumer Bureau for more time to comply include SunTrust, PNC, and BB&T. The Housing Policy Council, which is part of an organization representing the nation's largest financial firms, has taken the same stance. The Qualified Mortgage Regulation, as it's known, was mandated by the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act. The rule will require lenders to take more care in verifying a borrower's assets and ability to pay. The regulation will give lenders some protection from lawsuits. The goal of the rule is to protect borrowers from being saddled with mortgages they cannot afford or don't understand. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
Good afternoon. From the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston, I'm Christina Quinn with the local stories we're following. Lawyers for Boston mobster Whitey Bulger are asking a federal appeals court in Boston today to remove the judge assigned to Bulger's trial on murder charges. The defense says the judge has a conflict of interest because he was a federal prosecutor when Bulger was an FBI informant. A trial has started for a Newton man accused of being the hired gun in a fatal shooting over a $3 million inheritance. Robert Upton is charged with killing Aris Manolulis in Hyannis in 2009. The victim's brother was acquitted of plotting the killing. Lee firefighters are trying to figure out who's been stealing thousands of dollars worth of parts from an antique 1939 fire truck they hope to restore. Chief Alan Sparks tells the Berkshire Eagle the only use for the parts, other than the truck itself, would be selling them for scrap. Former Rhode Island Representative Patrick Kennedy says he's established a group to lobby against legalized marijuana. The ex-congressman says efforts around the U.S. to legalize marijuana are well-intentioned but misguided. The Providence Journal reports that Kennedy's group, Project SAM, for Smart Approaches to Marijuana, will instead lobby for increased treatment for marijuana and drug abuse. And Rhode Island's Governor Lincoln Chafee is touring the state's first addiction recovery community center to learn about efforts to fight drug dependence in the state. Governor Chafee is visiting the Anchor Recovery Center today and meeting with staff and people who have used the facility's programs. The Pawtucket facility was the state's first community center focusing on people looking for help with substance abuse and mental health issues. Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. It's 44 degrees outside of our Brighton studios under partly cloudy skies, and we can expect partly cloudy to sunny conditions throughout the rest of the afternoon with temperatures in the mid-40s. Tonight, mostly clear in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with overnight lows in the lower 30s. Wednesday, mostly sunny skies again, highs in the upper 40s. Right now, 44 degrees in Boston, 43 in Worcester, and 45 in Providence. I'm Christina Quinn. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. We are filling in today live on 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
And Marjorie, the long national nightmare is over. We are back on the radio.
I don't think most people view it as a long national nightmare, Jim.
Okay, maybe not. In any case, joining us in the studio, talking about political conflict on Capitol Hill and back here at home, former candidate for the Republican nomination for the Kentucky Senate seat, now held by Rand Paul, Trey Grayson. He's now head of the Institute of Politics. Hey, Trey, how are you?
Hey, good to see you.
And from Goldman Associates, he actually is Goldman Associates, Democratic strategist Michael Goldman. How you doing, Michael?
Someone has to be. Why not?
Exactly. Beautifully put.
Are we the associates?
That's right. Thank you guys both for being with us today. So let me start with you, Trey. Is Hagel the right guy for defense, or is he not?
Well, I think he's going to get confirmed, most likely, unless something new comes up. And the president certainly thinks he's the right guy. And David Brooks this morning in the New York Times had an interesting column making the case for why Obama picked him, that he gives him some cover as the first enlisted man to whatever be the first enlisted man to ever be Secretary of Defense, and a Republican, or at least nominally a Republican. They're probably going to have to be defense cuts. And having a Republican and somebody who still has shrapnel in his stomach give some credibility to maybe do that at the Pentagon.
But that's only half a story. Michael, what I don't get about this, with all these huge issues that Obama's got to deal with, from the debt ceiling to immigration to guns, all that sort of thing, a lot of gays are unhappy, number one. A lot of the pro-Israel constituency is unhappy. And most Republicans are not happy either. Why did he decide to spend all this political capital on a guy he didn't have to choose? By the way, when he wouldn't spend it on his good friend Susan Rice for Secretary of State.
I think there's a fundamental difference between those two choices. And I do agree with your premise. So I think you're correct in saying this is going to be a costly nomination. I think, Trey, you agree. That said, I think that there is a part of what's going on here that has to do with Obama won. When Obama went in there, there was this sense that people, particularly on the political left, had, put aside the Israel piece for a second, that he was going to change the foreign policy of the neocons, the foreign policy of the Bill Kristols and of George W. Bush. He went in there and implemented essentially a program which has kept and stayed the course in terms of how we're getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan. I think he now wants to go in there as he's exiting these places and put in a footprint that says, I had to live with that. I didn't do it because I wanted to. I did it because it is mm-hmm. what it was.
Was that
but
my premise?
Now,
how's he staying the course in Iraq and Afghanistan?
He was very critical of Iraq.
He's choosing a guy. Exactly.
Get troops out of Afghanistan.
You've got a guy there now in Hagel who literally was a guy who was a stand-up guy. And quite frankly, early on, after having made the bad vote as Kerry did on Iraq, quickly understood what many of us did. You and I talked about it how many times on the radio. The Obama foreign policy is going to be the foreign policy of John Kerry and Hagel,
Trey,
which is not a
let me get back to you for a second.
That they've been having in the last 4 years.
Let me get back to you for one second, Trey. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina is all over television. He's on CNN State of the Union. Listen to what he had to say over the weekend.
He has long severed his ties with the Republican Party. This is an in-your-face nomination by the president to all of us who are supportive of Israel. I don't know what his management experience is regarding the Pentagon, little if any. So I think it's an incredibly controversial choice. And it looks like the second term of Barack Obama is going to be an in-your-face term.
My attitude, Trey, has always been Republican or Democrat in the White House, unless they pick, I don't know, Hannibal Lecter to be the secretary of something, you give the man in office his choice. What is Graham doing here?
Well, there's a couple things. One, I'll go to the partisan thing. He is right in the sense that Hagel endorsed Obama in 08 over McCain and while he was a sitting U.S. senator. And then in this last cycle, he endorsed the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. Bob Kerry, who's served together in a longtime friend.
Nebraska, yeah.
Over the Republican, who ended up winning. The Republican Party does not love Chuck Hagel. He kind of had a falling out, but he's still actually nominally Republican. But you also have – he's got the vote. So I think some of the things that's going on here is for the Republicans, this is a chance to make a lot of noise, to examine Obama's foreign policy. Because I think Michael's right. These are his selections for this time. This is the Obama view of the world, and he can do it unconstrained. And 4 years ago, he was a young U.S. senator without a lot of international experience. So he had Hillary Clinton and he kept Bob Gates around. And so this is his team.
A Republican too, by the way.
Who was also a Republican. Yeah. Bush, so yeah. I think it gives Republicans an opportunity to go after Obama a little bit. At the end of the day, the question will be, will they filibuster? Because if they don't filibuster, there's no question that he's going to get confirmed. But even if they do filibuster, I would imagine there's got to be 10 Republicans who would vote with all the Democrats to confirm the guy when all is said. Now, the other thing is Lindsey Graham is one of the biggest supporters of AIPAC in the United States Senate. So that for him, that also could play a big role. And he's very close to John McCain.
Pro-Israel lobby in the United States, the leading pro-Israel lobby.
Let me ask you something, Michael Graham. Hagel did,
Michael
of course.
Michael Goldman,
Michael
too.
Goldman. Whoops,
he's
Michael
never going to get over that,
sorry,
Marjorie.
Michael Goldman. Forgive me. Michael Goldman. Hagel did make this very, what he called, insensitive remark about gays back in 1998, talking about this Ambassador Luxembourg being, openly gay and aggressively gay and all that kind of stuff. That was 1998. A lot of gay activists are saying it was a long time ago. We'll cut him some slack on this. What do you think?
I think that's correct. I mean, we have come probably farther on a national basis, and I mean that as a national issue, on the issue of gays in America in the last 12 years than we ever came quickly to civil rights. The country has slowly but surely understood that there is it's a tidal wave. We've been so close to it, Margie, that we haven't seen it. It is not a surprise that back in 98 he said this, and it's not a surprise today that he's embarrassed by it.
You don't have to go there, though. I mean, the reality is at the same time that he's saying what he's saying, we had a president of the United States, a Democratic president, who was Mr. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Mr. Defense of Marriage Act, Bill Clinton. In any case, speaking of gays, the first openly gay member of Congress, I think, ever is a local guy. Here's what he had to say. It's sort of a surprise on MSNBC's Morning Joe. I think it was this past Friday.
February, March, and April are going to be among the most important months in American financial.
So you'd consider it?
I'm not going to be coy. It's not anything I've ever been good at. I've told the governor that I would now like, frankly, to do that because I would like to be a part of that. It's only a 3-month period. I wouldn't want to do anything more. I don't want to run again. Right. But yeah, I think for these, it's almost, to be honest, a little arrogant.
Coach, it's going to not be summer. It's going to be a cold winter.
Yeah, coach, put me in.
Okay. Trey, should the coach put in Barney Frank? What do you think?
Well, the Boston Globe today certainly gave a rousing endorsement of the
lead editorial. Yeah,
yeah. It puts Patrick in a box. I mean, everybody knows the guy's qualified. He'll hit the ground running, and he's right. It is an important several months for the Congress, and so if you appoint somebody who doesn't, like a cabinet secretary, to kind of prop up their image for a future off, which was one of the possible types of a selection. If he does something like that, the governor will look pretty bad. But the governor's his own man.
Yep.
And the congressman retired. And we'll just have to see how this
plays
out.
I think he doesn't feel so well about retiring as he did just a couple of weeks ago,
And Doug Rubin, Doug Rubin weighed in, who's the governor's political guy and Elizabeth Warren's political guy.
He tweeted and said, quote, there are better candidates for Massachusetts Senate. Although, speaking of the governor himself, for whom Doug Rubin works, here's what Deval Patrick had to say about Barney Frank's application for employment.
We had a conversation, I think it was just yesterday. I think I've told you before, in every case, I have treated those conversations as confidential, and I think in every case the other person has treated them as confidential. In Congressman Frank's case, he's chosen not to on his end. I'm going to keep my end confidential.
I love that. He was not happy. This is not the Val Patrick's modus operandi,
exactly.
Correct?
And by the way, you know, I'm a little bit surprised. I guess I shouldn't be. Barney is Barney, and I've known him going back to my early days with the Dukakis administration. He was the state rep for Beacon Hill, and then later we actually shared for a period of time an office in Trey's a building at the Kennedy School.
Does he scream at you?
luckily for me, we always seem to never be there at the same time, which is why we shared the office. But you know, this is a really interesting thing. What do we want in someone who's in there for a very short period of time? And
you think Elizabeth Warren wants a guy who's going to upstage her in her first 4 months?
By the way, that was the good thing about Paul Kirk. He had a certain experiential base, but John
Interim
Kerry's
senator after Ted Kennedy died.
But John
he's
Kerry
not getting Barney Frank's not getting this, is he?
No,
Michael Goldman.
I'll tell you, it would not surprise me to see him do something counterintuitive, to put in someone who is a minority or put in somebody who has no political experience whatsoever.
Like who? Who would that be?
Well, I think Doug Rubin made a list. You know, a Margaret Marshall would be an interesting. I think he wants to do something that's counterintuitive. The one thing you don't do with this governor, I think you guys covered him for long enough to know this. You had him on the show every month. You do not want to put him in a box. He doesn't like it. He doesn't react well to it. And I think that I haven't spoken to Doug Rubin, but I presume that he did not act unilaterally with his tweet.
Okay, Michael, I want to stay with you for a second. The one thing I do not get, I usually can see both sides of something. The open Senate seat, not the interim thing, but the permanent thing. There has been this boomlet for Ed Markey that I have to say I don't get. This is no disrespect intended to Ed Markey. John Kerry, who never endorses in primaries, endorsed him in the shortest measurable unit of time. Vicky Kennedy is endorsing. The Democratic Senatorial Committee has endorsed him. What's up with this? I mean, why is this happening?
Well, I think that if you talk to people on the inside, they make the point that Ed Markey's wife is very close with both Teresa Hines and with Vicky Kennedy, and that they have a relationship that is based in D.C., and it's a strong one, number one. Number two, I think that, you know, it may very well go back in terms of John Kerry himself to the fact that he dumped out of the race in 1984 and literally helped take a major player out of the race that he eventually won against Jim Shannon. The bigger piece here, though, that's interesting to me is with all due respect, again, Ed Markey comes from Malden. I come from Malden. I've known him literally my whole life, his whole political career.
However,
I really like him. But he's not the kind of guy who you walk away from. It would be one thing if honestly, you guys, to you, Margie, and to you, Jim, let me ask you a question. If somebody said to you, I just found two pieces of news. John Kerry just endorsed somebody and promised to put his full political weight behind him, and Menino did. Which of those would give you pause for thought?
You mean what's more serious? Obviously,
yeah.
Tom Menino. Your endorsement is huge.
And so I think you've got two, possibly three people out there absolutely seriously thinking about it. If I could just...
By the way, Michael, we'll ask the question,
but
thank
you
very much.
Okay, finish. I have a question here.
Just the last thought, and that is just to say that, remember, in the case of, let's say, Mike Capuano, he has two options on the table politically. He can run for Senate, he can be governor. I think Lynch has two options he thinks on the table. He can run for Senate or become mayor. Ed Markey's got one option on the table. It costs him nothing to get out fast, and he's done a great job the way he's done it. Whether it'll work or not, we'll see.
Let me end this with you, Trey Grayson, though, because, you know, I've heard people off the record, Democrats, who are not saying such wonderful things about Ed Markey, people calling him like a wet noodle, an unimpressive campaigner. I interviewed a guy that lives next door to him for 30 years in Malden. Never seen the guy. He's lived next door to him for 30 years. He thought
there's
maybe he might have seen him about
Senate,
20 years ago. I don't get the Ed Markey thing at all.
Well, I think it probably is Markey really wants to run. And one of the lessons, maybe not the right lesson, but a lesson of the Scott Brown special election victory was that a divided Democratic Party is a vulnerable Democratic Party. And so given that Markey stuck his head out first, wanted to run, and at the end of the day, you know, it is Massachusetts. It happened once. It could happen again. But, you know, I think a unified Democratic Party makes a much more formidable opposition to somebody like a Scott Brown. It might even deter. I think this is also a deterrent effect, because notice Scott Brown actually has not declared that he's a candidate yet for this race.
And well, so he's semi-declared on one of my favorite radio shows, this Jim and Marjorie thing, where he basically gratuitously took a shot at Markey. Last question for
you.
Speaking of Scott
Who
Brown,
wins?
Right. Is,
exactly.
is this Brown's seat to win here?
Brown's, you'd have to say, is the favorite, I think, especially until you, if another Democrat gets in. And why wouldn't one of those Democrats jump in the race?
And I think both of
them. Because they don't have to give up the congressional seat to do it, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
But you do lose the second opportunity, Jim. As you know, Michael Kept want to make, will probably not get three bites at the apple. And so if you think you have an option, you think harder. And everyone's doing what they should be doing. Everyone's playing the kabuki dance perfectly.
And I'm doing I should be doing, which is thanking you, Michael. And what's the name of your deal again?
It's Goldman Associates.
I love that name, actually. Trey Grayson
from
forever. Grayson Associates, otherwise right. known as the Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School. Gentlemen, it's great to see you.
Hey,
thanks for being here.
Good luck with you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time to be with us. Billy Sine already did 2.5 years in jail for hitting and severely injuring a state trooper. Now that state trooper has died, and Sine has been indicted again, this time for vehicular homicide. Full details on this case and your take on what is a very, very unusual second indictment after this quick break.
Hello, I'm John Abbott, president of WGBH. The new year is always an exciting time, especially when it coincides with an all-new season of a show like Downton Abbey, the British drama brought here to the States courtesy of WGBH's own masterpiece classic. WGBH supporters, keep an eye out for my letter about the next great series from Masterpiece. And thanks for helping WGBH plan another incredible year of incredible programs.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Boston Symphony Orchestra New Year's Resolution Ticket Event, January 10th through February 5th. Details, tickets, and more information available at bso.org. That's bso.org. And White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill in Westwood, providing assisted living services in a home environment for those with Alzheimer's disease or other memory impairment. When your loved one can't remember your address, you can remember this one, whiteoakcottages.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
10 years ago, when he was 18, Billy Sine struck the park cruiser of State Trooper Ellen Engelhardt, parked in a breakdown lane. She was left in a permanent vegetative state, as Bella English described in her story in The Globe earlier this week. 2 years later, in 2005, Sine apologized in court, pled guilty to causing bodily injury when driving drunk and reckless endangerment, and served 2.5 years in jail. Years later, in June of 2011, Engelhardt died. And Sine, who's now head of a successful real estate firm in Cambridge, faces vehicular homicide charges, could be tried again, and could do 15 years more in jail. We're going to take your calls in a minute at 877-301-8970. Should Sine be retried, or has he paid his debt to society? Joining us on the phone is the lawyer who represented Sine in the plea deal years ago, former federal prosecutor, white-collar criminal defense lawyer, Paul Kelly. Good morning, Paul.
How are you?
Excellent.
Hi,
thanks for the call.
Thanks for joining us. So this is obviously a tough case, Paul, but Trooper Engelhardt is dead now. She was not dead. She was surviving, very seriously injured when your client pled guilty. Why doesn't her death change his situation dramatically? Why shouldn't it?
Well, you know, in any case where there is an injury, whether it results from an assault of some kind, a shooting, a serious traffic accident, the criminal justice system would grind to a halt if defendants charged with some role in those matters elected not to conclude their cases until, you know, some final chapter. I mean, here there was an 8-year difference between this terrible accident in July of 2003 and when Billy Sine was when Trooper Engelhardt unfortunately passed on and died, and then Billy was charged with the vehicular homicide charge. But he was charged immediately after the event. And then a year or two later, his case came before the court. He was charged with, you know, serious bodily injury. You know, the victim was, you know, obviously terribly and permanently injured. But according to the medical experts, her condition had stabilized, and she was likely at the time, they told us, you know, possibly, you know, could live until she was into her 70s, you know, another 20 or 30
right.
years. And so at the time, you know, look, it made sense to not only begin the healing process for, you know, Trooper Englehart's family, but also for the Sine family as well. And you know, he took the action that I think was the correct and prudent action at the time, and he resolved it without a trial.
Hey, Paul, we're talking to Paul Kelly, who was the lawyer for Billy Sine when he pled guilty years ago and then did 2.5 years in jail. You're not arguing there's a double jeopardy issue here. You're arguing, I assume, that the prosecutor shouldn't have charged him. The guy's gotten his life together. He apologized. He did time. And everybody should move on. Is that not where you are?
No, that's correct. I mean, you know, from a legal, technical point of view, double jeopardy doesn't exist where you have a separate offense. And of course, you know, vehicular homicide or any kind of homicide is a separate offense from some act which causes injury. So because you have some additional element, to proof. So while technically they can bring the new charge against Billy Sine, my point is that I think it's you know, improper. I think it's, you know, it's a question of prosecutorial discretion. Does it make sense to prosecute this guy? Number one, after the passage of 8 years between the accident and her ultimate death. Two, in a situation where her own family is not in favor of a re-prosecution. Three, where he went off and did 2.5 years in the House of Correction and has apparently done everything correct since he emerged from the House of Correction. He has basically lived an exemplary life, you know, not only personally, but he's developed a successful business where he employs, you know, 20 people full time. I mean, he's on the right path, and what,
Paul,
is served? What is served by re-prosecuting him at this point
well,
in time?
Well, from a victim's perspective here, you could also say, you know, at the time of that your client pled guilty, the district attorney down there wanted 8 to 10 years. Your client got 2.5. Of course, he did plead, and that's significant. But he was going 100 miles per hour. He said himself he hadn't slept, what was it, in 24 hours? He drove, he drove from the Cape to Wayland, and then from Wayland back to the Cape or something like that at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is really reckless stuff, and someone is dead now, and he did 2.5 years. I'm not saying that's insignificant, but that's certainly a lot less. I think the maximum you can do for a vehicular homicide now is 15 years,
15,
is it not?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, a few things to say here. Number one, I mean, both sides had an opportunity to fully advocate their views as to what was the appropriate outcome, you know, before a respected judge, and weighing all the facts and circumstances, including hearing from the victim's family, her daughter and significant other at the time, imposed the sentence that the court deemed appropriate. I mean, and two, you know, look, at the time that this accident took place, Billy Sine was 1 month removed from high school. He had just graduated from high school. He was an 18-year-old kid. He made a series of misjudgments. I mean, look, that horrifies any parent that you'd think that your kid would engage in this kind of conduct. The reality is that, you know, he was with some friends on the Cape. You know, he had a couple of beers. He got a call from a girlfriend. He drove all the way up to Wayland. He stayed till some ungodly hour,
yeah.
Jumped back in the car and drove back down, fell asleep at the wheel. You know, the evidence is not that he was going 100 miles an hour. I know that was printed in Miss English's column. In fact, the evidence was that he was going about 80 miles an hour, still in excess of the speed limit. And his car veered off, and unfortunately, you know, a terrible, terrible, tragic accident ensued. And,
Paul, you know, one of the things that I found, we're talking to Paul Kelly, who, by the way, was the lawyer for Billy Sine during this plea in 2005. It led him to 2.5 years in jail. One of the most interesting things in Belle English's piece in The Globe was when she mentioned that the plea, his guilty plea from 2005, could actually be admitted as evidence in a trial for vehicular homicide should it happen next year. But it seems that she mentioned the point, it cuts both ways. On one hand, it's a disaster for him because it basically says I'm guilty. On the other hand, it has potential to cause the jury to say, hey, he did his time, let's move on. No?
Well, I think it does cut both ways, and frankly, I'm not sure that judges will allow it to be admitted, even if the state wishes to admit it. I mean, I think there are many judges out there who would say that it's far more prejudicial, overwhelmingly prejudicial, and really not probative. I mean, how can anyone possibly get a fair trial, you know, with that piece of evidence? And so, I mean, I'm not sure it's a foregone conclusion that it would be admitted.
Okay.
But I also think I think Bella makes a good point. I mean, I think that, there are a number of citizens, whether they're jurors, judges, or just ordinary citizens, who hear the facts and circumstances of this case, may have pause as to whether or not this young man ought to be punished a second time.
The numbers here are 877, or the number is, I should say, 877-301-8970. If you'd like to weigh in on this case, it's a really tough case. As we said before, Paul Kelly's client, young kid at the time, Billy Sinead, 18 years old, he did apologize in court. He was very contrite. He didn't fight this. He didn't bring it to a trial to put the family through a lot of extra grief and aggravation. He pled guilty. He served 2.5 years at a maximum security facility, which is no joke. It was the Plymouth House Correction. By the way, Paul, correct me if any of these facts are wrong. This is from the Bella English great piece in the Boston Globe. Now the trooper has died. The accident occurred in 2003. She died in 2011. Should he be retried? A trial date is set in Brooklyn Superior Court. It's going to be very soon. Should this young man be retried, or has he served his time, and should he be allowed to continue with his life?
Hey, Paul Kelly, one last question for me. Have you spoken to Billy Sine since these new charges have been leveled against him, or no?
Yes, I have, many times.
And how's he dealing with this personally? Forget the law for a second. How's he dealing with this as a human being?
You know, he's very distraught, upset, frightened, fearful of how this will play out, and obviously deeply concerned. I mean he's he's got this incredible feeling of guilt, which he will live with for the rest of his life. He's been trying to do the right thing. He's been trying to lead an exemplary life. He knows that, you know, his conduct, even as an 18-year-old, caused this terrible, terrible, tragedy to take place. I don't know what more we can ask of a person, particularly a teenager. Does it serve, society's end to take this kid who's done so many good things over the last several years and throw him in some prison for 15 years?
Yeah.
Hey, Paul Kelly,
that's just not fair.
Paul Kelly represented Billy Sinead during this guilty plea in 2005. Thank you so much for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970. Should he be retried, Billy Sinead, or has he paid his debt to society?
You know, there was a great anecdote in Bella English piece in the Globe about how after the indictment for the vehicular homicide, when Trooper Ellen Engelhardt died, his driver's license was suspended. So he is walking everywhere now. He can't drive, and he's got this real estate office with 20 employees, and he talked. He didn't say this in a, oh, woe is me kind of thing, but he just presented it as fact that he's going through shoes like crazy because he's walking everywhere now, unable to drive, and he cannot get a loan to expand his business because, of course, his future is totally up in the air.
Let's go to Patrick in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on Boston Public Radio, 89.7. Welcome, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. What's up?
Basically, I just had a comment. I think in this kind of situation, we really need to think about the tenants, or, why we go to trial and why there's punishment. And, I mean, instinctively, I have, three major motivations, and I could be wrong, but I think number one is retribution to the victim and the victim's advocates, is one of the first tenets for punishment. And then secondly is to punish the person themselves, because crime has a punishment. And then third is to give a clear signal to society that, for every crime there's punishment. So I think we have those three factors when we consider a society's punishment of a person.
So where do those but where do those three criteria lead you? What do you conclude?
Okay, so in this one, I think we have to consider which one of those, usually when we go to trial, I think all three of those are being addressed. And in this situation, I think we have to think which one of those is being addressed. The victim and the victim's family at this point, because that's really those are victim's advocates, seem okay with it. Punishment-wise, that's probably the only point that you could try to argue here are we punishing this man? And that's, I think, a weak argument, and clearly the signal to society that, there's something, there's a punishment for what you do has already been addressed. So basically, I don't think any of those three tenants are strong.
So Patrick, your conclusion, just so I'm clear, is that essentially he's suffered enough, he's done his time, move on. Is that correct?
more so that by going to trial, we'd be adhering to a rudimentary system rather than addressing one of the tenets that I think the legal process is meant to serve. And holding so tightly to a system when you're not really doing it for the purpose almost becomes...
Got it. We got it. Hey, Patrick, thank you so much for the call. And by the way, in this piece by Bell English on the Globe, it should be mentioned that her boyfriend, not only on his own behalf, but he says he's speaking for Trooper Engelhardt's daughter as well, say they were not behind the initiation of this further prosecution.
They didn't seek this indictment. The daughter didn't want to talk about it, but the boyfriend did say that. Let's go to William calling from Newport, Rhode Island. What do you think about this case, William?
Well, I think it's a little hard. I knew Billy as a student. I taught him computing.
You did?
Yeah, I did, and I've reached out to him since the case came back up, and I think he's quite contrite, and I think he's really done amazing things with putting his life together after this extraordinary tragedy.
And what did he say to you when you spoke to him after this these new charges, this vehicular homicide thing?
I had not spoken to him. We exchanged emails. One of the things in the Bella English story was that he was receiving some very threatening and very aggressive emails about how he was worthless. And so my sense was that I had known him before the event, before he went to the House of Corrections. He was a good student, had a great sense of humor, was a kid who was going to go somewhere, and it was really extraordinary to see how he put things back together. And I just wanted to reach out and tell him that, you know, there are some people who do not think that he's worthless.
William, thank you very much for the call. Bella English in the Globe piece did point out, you referencing these horrible things people said, that one man called his Sine's office and asked one of the agents who works for him, how does it feel to be working for a murderer, which is pretty tough stuff. And also, because his parents obviously had to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to cover his legal fees, he went to work as a junior when he was at a special school within Boston College to get his real estate license and start working part-time at Century 21. And then he went on in the spring of his junior year. In his junior year in college, he opened his own real estate agency. And that's where he's working now and trying to expand. But he can't get the loan because, as I said before, because of his future being up in the air. So the kid is clearly, he's not a kid, he's 28 years old, but he's clearly a contrite. And he was contrite from the start, which you don't often see coming from a defendant in the case.
Yeah, but
like
I hear a lot of people say that, Marjorie. They say if contrition gets you where you want to go, is it legitimate contrition or is it studied contrition in the hopes that you can get a decent outcome? Joining us on the phone is former prosecutor and probably America's premier victims' right advocate, Wendy Murphy's with us. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, guys. Welcome to the new planet here.
Thanks.
Thank
what
you
should
very
happen
much.
To this guy, Wendy?
Well, you know, I totally disagree with both what Paul Kelly was saying and what some of the callers are saying about how he doesn't deserve more punishment. But let me put that aside for a second. I think when a person dies, and especially by a criminal act such as this, 2.5 years is a deep discount. And I don't believe in deep discounts when you're trying to stop the behavior. It sends a wrong message and so forth. But look, nobody's saying the guy's going to get even one day behind bars, much less 15 years. So that's a bunch of nonsense. The fact is he's being prosecuted, okay? It's highly likely that even at the end of the day, his lawyer will effectively argue to the judge, he's already served 2.5 years, he's a good guy, and so forth and so on. Just hand the judge Bella English's column, and he'll probably serve no additional time. The question is, should he be pursued? And the answer is, of course he should. Why? A human being is dead. There has been no justice for the death of this innocent trooper. End of discussion. There has been no justice.
But you know something, Wendy? I know this is not technically double jeopardy, but I think you're putting people, defendants, guilty though they may be, in a terrible position where if they are convicted of assault and battery in 2000 and in 2013 that person dies, then they're back facing a second-degree murder charge or a manslaughter charge. I mean,
you know what the solution is, Marjorie? Don't drive at 100 miles an hour and don't drink before
again,
you drive at 100 miles an hour. Then you don't have to worry about it.
But this kind of almost, not technically, but in some sense a double jeopardy thing applies to every crime, Wendy. How do we conduct the criminal justice system that way?
No, and you make a fair point, but it cuts both ways. Here's why. I was a prosecutor. I saw these kinds of cases, drunk driving accidents where the person ends up debilitated but not dead, but probably will die. That's not brand new. The concept is, you know, do we wait for the person to die before bringing the charges, or do we do justice now and then maybe a little bit of extra justice later? The funny part is, and the irony here is, lots of defendants in these circumstances rush to the courthouse to plead guilty. And their lawyers say, hurry, hurry, plead guilty, because you don't want this person to die. That's a much tougher crime. And, you know, you don't want to reward these bad guys because they've committed a crime where the person isn't yet dead. If anything, one could argue that because she suffered for so long and then died, that it's a much worse crime than had he killed her instantly at the moment that he hit her.
Hey, Wendy, let me ask you one last question. Let's assume you're the judge in this case. Based on what you've said to us, the jury convicts here, leaves it in your hands. What do you do with this guy? You let him go for his 2.5 years served years ago, or do you give him more time? What do you do, Wendy?
Well, I'll tell you this. I would push him hard on his apparently false claim, which was in the Bella English piece, and Paul Kelly today, his lawyer, suggested that wasn't the truth, that he didn't drink, that he wasn't drunk. If he hasn't accepted responsibility fully, I might whack him a little bit. He said he wasn't drunk, but blew a .05 4 hours later.
Yeah.
That guy had to be in a coma.
Well, he said he drank earlier in the day. He said he didn't.
You don't blow a .05 4 hours later unless you were half dead at the time of the incident. So I would force him to tell the truth about that. I would absolutely put him on the spot for being untruthful about that. And I would ask him, you know, are you suggesting that because of the PR in the Boston Globe, you should get a discount? Because it's a very sympathetic story. It is a sympathetic story that really doesn't ask the right question. Not should he spend one more day behind bars, but should we prosecute him for causing the death of a human being? Answer yes. Why? Because he did it.
Wendy, thanks so much.
Wendy Murphy, thank you very much, as always, for being with us. It's Wendy Murphy, a victim advocate.
Thanks,
Let's take one more call here.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in. Should he be retried? Or essentially, as we said earlier in the day, we were talking to Paul Kelly, 28 years old. He has a real estate business he's put together in Cambridge, has 20 employees. He has been contrite, both in court and subsequently. And by the way, one of the things he said in the Bell English piece, he would not have pled guilty in 2005 to the lesser charges had he known that he might be prosecuted later.
Well, the other thing is, just as I said to Wendy, on a practical level, I don't know how you run the court system this way, changing everything around when the...
Well, it doesn't happen that often. That's how you run the court system.
I think it happens, not necessarily in a drunk driving situation.
What, a death years later?
Yes, or a year later, or two years later,
crimes,
after the case has been adjudicated. Let's go to Andrew from Worcester. Hi, thanks for calling WGBH Radio, Andrew.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I knew Billy. I grew up with him. He was a summer camp instructor for me, and he's a phenomenal guy. I mean, he was my favorite instructor. He went through the process already. He accepted responsibility. He pled guilty. The justice system made their verdict, and it seems just cruel. It just seems insensitive to bring this up again. He's trying to move on with his life, and.
But Ellen Engelhardt can't move on with her life, Andrew. I mean,
the problem is
Ellen Engelhardt, who was essentially brain dead since 2003 and then was literally dead 8 years later. How about her half of the equation, regardless of what her boyfriend and daughter apparently want?
Yeah. Yes, so we're going to now destroy two lives when
You can say that in any case when someone does something horrible to somebody else. Obviously, the perp, in this case, Billy Sine. Obviously, there's some damage, but as I said to Marjorie before, I guess the solution for that is don't drive too fast and don't drive drunk. But Andrew, thank you kindly for your call. We appreciate it.
Paul from Milton, you are on 89.7 WGBH. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, what a nice surprise.
Thank you.
There is life after what?
Well, it's a short life.
Yeah,
we're here till 2 o'clock, but we shall see.
Support, I believe.
Hey, Paul, what's going on?
Very good. I read the article by Bella English in the Sunday Globe, and to me, the real criminals in this are the insurance company that represented the Sine family. The Engelhardt family had to take Quincy Mutual Fire Insurance Company to court to get paid. They did not want to pay for Trooper Engelhardt's care, and I think the judge threw the book at them. And I don't know what excuse they were saying, but they didn't want to pay the family.
Well, I thought they
for the
settled.
Care and maintenance.
I thought they sued for about $6 million and settled. Paul, isn't that my understanding?
Yeah,
am
but
I incorrect?
But they had to. I don't know what the settlement was, but the point was that they had to take Quincy Mutual Fire Insurance to court to get
shocking to hear an insurance company not wanting to pay a claim,
yeah,
isn't it, Paul?
Shocking. Yeah, it's totally shocking. You know,
Paul, aside from the insurance company, you're the prosecutor. What do you do here? Do you try him again, or do you say, listen, he did time, he was contrite, let's move on?
You know, I think there's a proximate cause. I mean, it's 8 years between the time of the accident. I don't know what the medical reports have said in the time that Trooper Englehart was in the whatever nursing facility she was in. What was the exact cause of death? Was it any way related to
Paul,
sure, you can't
anyway, I'd say always.
But well, that is a great point, though, because the
Paul,
jury
thanks.
Would have to convict
sure.
beyond a reasonable doubt that it was this accident that caused this death and not some complication from some other sort of ailment that she acquired while she was living in this very difficult physical state. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one for a jury.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. By the way, we should have thanked Kelly Crossley and Emily Rooney and the whole team for allowing us to sit in today, sort of occupying the studio till 2 o'clock. Let's go to Danvers, where Jackson is on the phone. We're talking about Billy Sine did 2.5 years in prison for hitting in a breakdown lane Trooper, State Trooper Ellen Englehart. She was in a vegetative state. She died years later. Now he is being prosecuted for vehicular homicide. What's your take on this, Jackson?
Yeah, hi. I just want to say up front, I'm a specialist in physical medicine rehabilitation. So I've worked with many patients who've suffered from being hit by drunk drivers in the past. And, you know, the thing that was said to me long ago by a state trooper in Utah when I worked there many years ago was, what if this had been a gun? What if he had shot the trooper in the breakdown lane? What would be the punishment then? And, you know, people seem to equate drunk driving with, you know, being under the influence.
They don't consider it an intentional act.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. But if you were under the influence and you grabbed a shotgun out of your shotgun cabinet and went into your local mall with your finger on the trigger and stumbled around and then the gun went off, what would be the punishment for that?
I think that's actually an excellent point. I mean, the conventional wisdom in this society, even though I think the public sensitivity to it has been greatly enhanced, thanks to people like Ron Bersani, whose granddaughter, Melanie Powell, was the 13-year-old killed by a drunk driver. And then as a citizen activist, Ron practically single-handedly
changed
the laws
in the state of Massachusetts.
I mean, that
is a long uphill fight.
That is the notion. I think if you stop 10 people on the street, Jackson, and said, you know, as horrible as drunk driving is, and virtually everybody condemns it, I think most people would say you pick up a gun, it's an intentional act. And sadly, I think they'd say you drive a car drunk at 80 or 100 miles an hour. It's not an intentional act, even though it is.
But we should also point
out. Nobody, you know, nobody put the car keys, nobody forced
I agree with
the
you.
Car keys
That's
in your
true.
Hand and turn on the ignition and drive down the road. And
That's it, true.
It's asinine to me to believe that there's any difference between taking a multi-ton vehicle and slamming it into somebody and taking a shotgun while you're drunk and playing around with it.
Well put, Jackson. Thank you.
It's the same result.
You said it well, Jackson. Thank you so much for the call.
We should just point out this is maybe a little bit too nuanced, but because he was 18 years old and not 21, the legal limit for being drunk is lower. So he wouldn't have been considered drunk if he were an adult. And
he pled guilty to drunk driving.
He absolutely did. And he claimed, however, that he fell asleep at the wheel, that it wasn't having had those beers early in the evening that caused him to hit Trooper Englehart.
We're going to squeeze one more quick one in at 877-301-8970. Tony, you're in Marlboro, and you're on with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Tony.
Good afternoon, whatever it is.
Hi, Tony.
My whole take on the thing is I think they should let it go. The only two points I make. The only real thing is if at this point, if she's gone, there's nobody benefiting from it, and the family doesn't want anything to do with it. So why bring them through the whole process? Why clog up the courts anymore with any of the issues going on there? Might as well just let it be. The guy went to jail for 2.5 years. He did it when he was 18. I don't know. I'm 24 now. When I was 18, I've changed a lot since then, and I don't even remember. I couldn't tell you what type of nonsense I was doing when I was 18.
Well, Tony, if Billy Sine was listening, I have a feeling he'd like very much a call. Tony, thank you so much for the call. We also want to thank Paul Kelly, who was the lawyer for Billy Sine when he pled guilty in 2005, and Wendy Murphy, former prosecutor, now big-time victims' rights
advocate. Jim Browdy, should they try this Mr. Sine again?
I have to say, I am totally with the last caller. Is when the boyfriend and he speaking on behalf of the daughter of Ellen Engelhardt, State Trooper Ellen Engelhardt, says, we didn't initiate this, we didn't want this. My view is you follow the family.
Okay. I'm with you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, this is a good one for you, Jim. You want to make a few extra bucks for the kids' college fund or maybe for your
401k? I need it, let me tell you.
Well, then stay tuned. Up next, all you need to know about opening your own medical marijuana business.
You're listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
Marijuana was just legalized for recreational purposes in Colorado and Washington and Massachusetts on Election Day last November. Joined, I think it was 17 other states by a 2-1 margin, the public voted to legalize medical marijuana. But in the entrepreneurial era, Marjorie, want to set up a medical marijuana business? Well, Ariel Shear of the Boston Phoenix attended a training from something called Cannabis Career Institute, CCI, we call it, and she's with us in studio. Good morning, Ariel. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Now, Ariel, you apparently have attended many of these seminars run by this group and other groups about medical marijuana. So I want to know, because some of us, you know, might be a little intrigued by a little side job, a little extra money on the side. So what'd you learn and what did I miss out by not going to these seminars myself?
Well, it's interesting to look at the way people in Massachusetts are thinking about it, like really excited entrepreneurs. You've got people looking to grow, you know, and service patients. And then you've got the other side of the spectrum where there's options for plumbers and electricians to start like side work and helping set up those grow operations. So it's there's really a spectrum.
Well, you talked to a fellow up in Maine who was not doing what I envision, these kind of dispensaries that you go in with your right. prescription. He's almost like a doctor in a way. He's growing marijuana in his house. He's spending like half an hour a day with his patients. He wants to be a little down low about this because he's singing in the church choir, I guess, on the side. Doesn't right. want his other parishioners to know what he's up to. But what's his deal? I mean, could we do this in Massachusetts too?
Well, he's a caregiver up in Maine. They've got a limited number of dispensaries, and so patients have a hard time accessing medicine. Caregivers, like there are a number, like hundreds up in Maine licensed to grow for patients. In his situation, he's able to service his patients discreetly. He delivers them their medicine where they might not be able to get to a dispensary. In Massachusetts, we don't have dispensaries set up and it's going to be a while, but the ballot measure went into effect on January 1st, so we have patients and they will be looking for medicine, and caregiving is an option here as well.
How many people were in the class, the thing you went to, the seminar or whatever there was?
There were about 40 people. It was full.
And break it down for us. Is there are there, what, 10 stoners and 10... I mean, what is the breakdown? What were they like? What was the demographic in there?
Well, it was really wild. There were a handful of older women there. One of them was a guest lecturer who specializes in making edibles, like body bombs and making edible foods, you know, caring for terminally ill people. Oh. Instead of, you know, you don't just have to smoke the medicine. Here are all these other options.
She's the real deal. She was there sincerely.
Wait a minute. There's a weed body rub?
Oh, there's like a... there's
do you
a weed
get high?
Everything.
Do you get high from the body rub?
I think
put
they...
Put it on before work in the morning and go in? What's the deal with that?
The sense I've got from her, I've never experienced it personally, but she says she'll put it on a part of the body that hurts and it sort of medicates or helps that part of the body. And then she even had these lip balms, which she could apply during the day, and it would sort of give a little a kick to it. It's not, they sort of breed these strains with different properties so that there might be one that doesn't make you sleepy.
Marjorie's birthday is in June.
brother. Well,
if you, no, I'm serious. I know this woman. But so, okay, that's one. The other 30, well, you were one of the people there too as a reporter. What are the other 39? Are they real? Do they really want to do a business thing? What was their whole shtick?
I think there were growers there. You know, I wouldn't want to get anyone in trouble, but people who have experience doing this already in the state, and they're looking to sort of legitimize their craft. There were other people looking to start consulting services, which sort of there's a sort of a split. People use the, like, they say, you don't sell gold in a gold rush. You want to be in the picks and shovels business. So there are a lot of people interested in starting grow shops or, you know, for hydroponic supplies, and then people who just want to consult anyone interested in starting these businesses and offer those sort of services.
You know, there have been all these stories in the papers about local communities being very uptight about this, and they're worried about these dispensaries being next to daycare centers or whatever and
schools,
stuff like that.
Yeah.
So are these people worried about this, or are they just, I mean, this could really be a big entrepreneurial opportunity here, unless you have every town in Massachusetts saying you've got to be 500 feet from a park, 500 feet from a school or more. You know what I mean?
Right. And that's sort of just trying to avoid drawing attention from the feds. Like, you're more likely if you go to set up a dispensary. I mean, we have a long way to go till we get there in Massachusetts. But these people sort of, I think there's a lot more people after this sort of session looking to start those picks and shovels business than just being downright dispensaries. I mean, it looks like whatever the DPH establishes for that process of getting licensed to start a dispensary, you'll need a lot of startup capital, and it's going to be a process.
They're doing so well with the drug labs there over at DPH, too. They have plenty of time to be dealing with this. You know, one of the things I don't get, I don't know if this is part of your bailiwick, because I know we'll get back to the training session you went to in a minute. I have never understood how a politician with a straight face, like virtually every attorney, we had every DA on our radio show, every single one opposed it. I should be fair. I'm not sure if the attorney general did. The thing that I find so strange about this is none of them oppose a doctor prescribing OxyContin. None of them oppose. I mean, essentially, it's a doctor-patient kind of thing. What arguments does anybody have now that particularly now that the public has spoken about the whole issue of a doctor not being able to say this is what this man or woman needs to be pain-free, to be able to eat? I mean, did they get into any of that stuff, or they're just talking about the mechanics of how to produce it?
This was more addressing the mechanics of it. I think when you talk about doctors and you look at the way that, you know, the Mass Medical Society sort of came out against this. I think it's mostly because this is still like a Schedule I substance, you know, the way it's been classified. So it's deemed to have no medical value. And then you've got these states circumventing federal law. I mean, you've got the woman I mentioned earlier, she sort of seemed to me like a medicine woman, like a holistic sort of medicine woman. So it's sort of a counterculture to mainstream medicine.
You're looking at Marjorie. You ever meet Marjorie before, by the way?
Like acupuncture.
Could you see her as a medicine woman? Don't you? No, I get that.
You know what I think is going to happen? I think a lot of people are going to be developing pre-existing conditions, and then they're going to go down. Especially, you know,
no doctor is going to give them a prescription if they're fine.
How do you know? But doctors give prescriptions all the time.
Well, then it'll be no worse or better than that.
A lot of doctors overprescribe. I mean, I think it's one of the great problems with medicine in general today. So I don't see why this is necessarily any different. But I think also one of the things about this whole lessening of the restrictions around marijuana is the baby boomers who were smoking pot, as we used to call it, in the 70s and the 80s, and they've all grown up and they're taxpayers and they're not stoners. And so they realize that all this hysteria about marijuana is just that, hysteria.
Yeah, speaking of that, we've actually done two of potentially three steps in Massachusetts. And by the way, if you want to join us, our number is 877-301-8970. Jim and Marjorie sitting in on Boston Public Radio today.
Jim,
we're talking about this legalization of medical marijuana.
They want to have tips on how to start their own business. We have Ariel here, and she can give them some advice.
Say fine point.
How to get going.
Did they talk about the fact that, I mean, step number one was we decriminalized, I hope you used the right word, decriminalized possession of an ounce or less a couple of years ago on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Again, every law enforcement person opposed, 2-1, the voters said yes. Mm-hmm. Then 2-1 this past November, November 6th, whatever it was, 2-1, people say medical marijuana. Did it come up in the seminar that this is step one, these are steps one and two towards outright legalization for recreational purposes, a la Colorado, a la Washington, and you better be ready for that because there's a lot of money to be made in that business?
Well, the Cannabis Career Institute, they're based in California. So this was, I mean, we're dealing with Cali-style education, looking at things like making tinctures and edibles, which we don't know how readily available those things will be to patients in Massachusetts because we're waiting for the DPH. If you could hear your question one more time. I don't know if I hit it on.
No, were they talking about, I assume, I mean, what good business people do, I'm not a good business person, but what good business people do is they not only deal with current events, they deal with what is likely to happen.
Right.
And it seems to me, even though when Marjorie and I, we did these debates on this question, every proponent of legalization of medical marijuana, we said, this is just a step towards outright legalization.
Right.
Of course, they deny it.
Deal.
It's not a scam.
Well,
I didn't say it was a
scam. It's a semi-scam.
But the reality is that's next. Did they talk in this thing is be prepared for the legal, for the medical marijuana phase, but frankly, the next phase may be right around the corner where it is outright legal for recreational purposes. Get ready for that. I mean, that's when the floodgates open, do they not?
Right. It's. I mean, that's sort of what it felt like they were getting at in the seminar by covering such a broad spectrum, such, you know, questionable, like, we don't know what the situation will end up being here in the near future, but here's advice that you can take with you, you know, if we do fully legalize it for recreational use. And if you look at how people voted on that non-binding question four, if senators should be advocating to get this, you know, rescheduled and then perhaps move towards full legal, there was a lot of support for that as well. So
didn't it pass in? I think it passed in every. It's advisory. It passed in every single community, I think, on which it was on the ballot. We're talking to Ariel Shearer. She's a reporter for the Boston Phoenix, and you went to this Cannabis Career Institute.
That's a great name, isn't it? The Cannabis Career Institute.
Well, it sounds business-like and official.
Preparing the next generation of entrepreneurs. Doesn't that sound great?
So what
do you
learn?
How do you tell your parents
take...
that, though? How do you tell your parents that? You know, you just got out of college, and you haven't really had much success in getting a job, and mom and dad ask what you're doing, and you're starting a cannabis
dispensary. I think in your case, one would ask Marjorie, how do you tell your kids that you're starting?
Well, that is a good question. You wrote about this guy up in Maine, the caregiver,
right,
who is growing marijuana at his home, and he's a caregiver, and he's involved with these patients. He's got two older children. Now, it's legal. What did he tell his kids? Did you ask him that?
I did. And it actually, he told me that neither of his kids actually use marijuana, but this opened a door for conversations about drugs with his kids. And he has to be really careful because he fears if his son's friends found out that he was growing in the basement, they might, you know, have access to it. So he's worried about access, but he's also worried about people breaking in and robbing him because it's starting to get legitimized as an industry, but still sort of.
Do you ever see Weeds on TV?
Yes, actually.
One of the great shows of all time. Let's go up to Gloucester, where Rick is with us on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Good morning, Rick.
Hi, Rick. Are you there?
I think I threw him off when I said good morning. Good afternoon. Let me try it another way. Good afternoon, Rick. Exactly. Obviously, he was at the training, so he knows what is going. So what are next steps in terms of the state? I know, as Marjorie said, there's been this whole thing in local communities where many of them are not so crazy about putting the regulations in place. They, I think, correctly want to keep a certain distance from daycare centers, as Marjorie said, schools, that sort of stuff. What's the reality in terms of timing for DPH or whomever it is that promulgates the regulations? What's next before we actually see a dispensary, if that's the proper term, before we just see a dispensary somewhere?
Well, those separate little communities are working on zoning. Some have banned dispensaries from their communities outright. And we also have legislators working to introduce new legislation that would ultimately override question three or the provisions set by it. I'm sort of working on a piece about that for the Phoenix.
Wait, they
want
to repeal this thing? After the public has voted 2-1, I mean, I'm serious. Whether you're for it or not, the public has spoken over, and some of them want to undo what the public has done.
Why are you surprised by that, Jim? It happens all the time, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, not when it's that overwhelmingly, I think. But is that what they're trying to do?
Well, Senator John Keenan of Quincy wants to introduce this new the Massachusetts Medical Marijuana Act. He plans to file it before the deadline on January
18th. Which would do what?
If this thing gains traction, if it that long down the road ever passed, it would drastically change the measure that people voted on.
Cutting back on it.
It would ultimately give the DPH the final say of what doctors could prescribe marijuana as medicine for, when right now the law that's between a doctor and a patient.
Which
DPH.
Is the way it should be. Yeah. Ariel, we'll talk to Ariel Shearer from the Boston Phoenix, and our number is 877-301-8970. One of the things I never understood also, maybe this is a function of the federal prohibition or whatever it is, why do we even need dispensaries? Why can't CVS prescribe, allow us to take a prescription for medical marijuana just like you do for anything else? You hand it to the man or woman in the pharmacy, and they give you back whatever it is you're entitled to.
Well, this is actually another piece of Keenan's legislation, what he wants to do. He would have, rather than having these retail dispensaries where patients could go get their own medicine, they would be written as prescriptions that were filled by mail courier. and these dispensaries wouldn't be in residential communities, and that was his way of addressing that problem.
What do you mean?
You direct get to delivered your house
like
kind of
UPS
thing.
Would show up at your door?
I asked him
little
about
brown,
it.
Little discreet paper wrapping kind of deal?
He compared it to prescriptions that are currently filled by mail. I'm not very familiar with that system, but I tried to get a sense from him. It seemed it's unique. I haven't seen this put in place in other states.
Well, I just think this is all very exciting for those people who can't quite retire but want a little side job to supplement whatever retirement income they're making. I think this is a wonderful thing. Ariel, thank you very much for being with us. And people who haven't read it should read your great pieces. You're doing a whole series about marijuana legalization, or not legalization, but what is the movement toward legalization of the Boston Phoenix, correct?
Yeah, I've started a column called Common Sensey, and it's sort of covering the cannabis beat in the local impact of the national marijuana movement.
Hey, stick around one more second, by the way. We have a doctor on the phone who's actually apparently used medical marijuana. Mark, you're from Barrington, Rhode Island. You're on with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Mark?
Well, I'm a physician. I've used the active ingredient in marijuana to treat various conditions through the prescription form, Marinol. It's incredibly expensive, and that limits our ability to use it. I see several issues here. One is with dispensaries, the potential for abuse in young people with developing nervous systems, we really know that that's not very good for them, and the diversion that will occur. Also, the money problem of if it's illegal federally, you can't set up a bank account to store your money. And I think you're going to have, convenience store knockoffs. People are going to come in with guns and start robbing these places.
You know, Mark, one of the things about young people using marijuana, that I've heard that argument before, and with due respect, as you know, a kid that's 15, 16 can walk 10 feet in their high school and get all the marijuana they want. So
right.
I'm not clear why a kid is going to go through all this rigmarole to get some prescription to go to a dispensary when they don't have to go through that hassle.
Well, it's just one more thing about access. The more access you have, the more use you have. We've seen this with tobacco. I mean, you can get tobacco in your high school, too, but we have laws that control tobacco. And why do we do that? Because we know that it cuts down on access. And, we don't give psychoactive drugs to kids without thinking about it. And this is definitely psychoactive stuff. You know, we know that it has effects on learning. We know that those things exist.
Yeah, but Mark, the odd part, and Mark, thank you so much for your call. I trust the doctor. I trust the Marks of the world to make the right decisions, whether someone's 18 or 118. Mark, thank you for your call. And Ariel Shearer, writing great stories in the Boston Phoenix, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
See you,
Ariel. Thank you.
Take care.